I thought since Yom Ha'atzmaut is this week, we talk a little bit about some of the halachic issues and not so much the philosophy, although obviously that's going to be inevitable. Let me first start off with the technical issue of the recitation of Hallel. We know that, of course, the Rabbanut has paskened since 1948 that on the 5th of Iyar, or whatever, it gets complicated when it's Shabbos, Nitche, but whatever day they establish, Hallel Shalem should be recited with a bracha, because the establishment of the State of Israel was considered to be a geula, kind of a redemption from Hashem, and therefore it should be commemorated by the recitation of Hallel. And moreover, the Rabbanut also has the ruling that the restrictions of Svirat HaOmer, that the restrictions of music on the Omer also do not apply in Yom Ha'atzmaut, because the simcha of the occasion overrides it. Now, as you know, the Rabbanut's Psak is accepted in some circles and is not accepted in other circles. Some people say Hallel without a bracha. Some people say Hallel after davening as Pirkei Tehillim. Some people do not say Hallel at all. We know the classic response of the Panovich Rav, that the Panovich Rav although Panovich itself is obviously not a Zionist yeshiva, but the Panovich Rav himself was someone that supported the state, and he considered the state to be a very, very important thing. And because of that, to this day, in the Panovich yeshiva, they do raise the Israeli flag on Yom Ha'atzmaut. Now, I'm sure, Rav Shach kept that custom only because of honor to the Panovich Rav. Rav Shach would not have done this on his own, but he did not want to discontinue what the Panovich Rav started. And indeed, they don't even say Tachanun, or at least historically they did not say Tachanun, but they do not say Hallel. So the classic story goes that somebody said to the Panovich Rav, if you're such a Tzioni, how could it be that you don't say Hallel and Yom Ha'atzmaut? What type of Tzioni are you? You're not authentic. He says, what do you mean? I celebrate Yom Ha'atzmaut exactly the way Ben-Gurion celebrates it. He says, didn't say Tachanun and didn't say Hallel. He says, how can you accuse me? Again, it's one of the classic responses. But it's interesting that the Panovich Rav's very, very dear friend, the Chazon Ish, did take a very, very opposite position. The Chazon Ish absolutely held that you do not mark Yom Ha'atzmaut as a chag in any way. And it is a story that is recorded that once there was a bris on the 5th of Iyar. And on a bris, you don't say Tachanun. But the Panovich Rav Paskin, they should say Tachanun even at a bris, so that nobody should misconstrue that they didn't say Tachanun because of the 5th of Iyar. Now, in truth, again, I'll give you a little background on this, but in truth, although it's fairly safe to say as a generalization that most of the Torah world that we call Haredi do not mark Yom Ha'atzmaut, and the Dati Leumi Torah world does. That's kind of a very rough approximation. But the truth of the matter is, that's a little bit of a recent phenomenon. If you actually go back to 1948, the 1950s, the first decade of the state, positions were not so polarized, and they were not so maybe as well-defined as they are today. And there were many, many Haredim, many people from the old Yishuv, the old Yerushalmi Yishuv, who felt that Yom Ha'atzmaut was a chag, was a Yom Tov, and it should be celebrated in one way or the other. The concept, the polarization in which Haredim became such a definitive block and position is really a product of the late 70s, then 80s, and on. In the early years of the Medina, there were a lot of people who did celebrate Yom Ha'atzmaut. And indeed, even in the United States, it's interesting, somebody unearthed a program, a Yom Ha'atzmaut program in Cleveland from the 1950s, Yom Ha'atzmaut program, in which the participants and the speakers were the Rosh Yeshiva of the Telz Yeshiva, Rav Elia Meir Bloch, Rav Matel Katz. These were real, I'm using the word Haredi, it's an anachronism. Haredi was not the term even used then. But today we would call them real Haredi, black hat, Rosh Yeshivas, who participated in a Jewish federation Yom HaTzmaut program. And again, I mean, I did not grow up in a particularly black hat right wing community, but again, when I grew up, it was very, very common that Orthodox Jews of all persuasions, whether they were called Yeshivisha or Hasidisha or whatever it is, they all gathered together and celebrated. Whether they said Hallel with the bracha, without a bracha, that's another question. But certainly this notion of just ignoring the day is relatively recent, and it represents a kind of an ascendancy of the Shita of the Chazon Ish. Now, the Chazon Ish himself went through ambivalent stages. When the Chazon Ish came to Eretz Yisrael, he came to Eretz Yisrael before World War II. He came to Eretz Yisrael in the 30s. And Rav Kook was still alive. And initially, the Chazon Ish was very, very drawn to Rav Kook. He saw Rav Kook as a visionary. He saw Rav Kook as an absolute gadol in Torah and a leader of Am Yisrael. Later, for various reasons, the Chazon Ish took a different position, and because of that, for the last 20 years of his life, he never went to Yerushalayim. And the story that they give is because he didn't want to visit Yerushalayim while Rav Kook was alive, because then he would have to visit Rav Kook, and he didn't want to visit Rav Kook, but he didn't want to not visit him, because that would be a bizayon. And when Rav Kook was nifter in the 1930s, he felt he didn't want to go to Yerushalayim because then people will say the reason he didn't go before was because Rav Kook was alive. So there was a whole complicated cheshbon in which he didn't want to insult Rav Kook and he didn't want to openly honor him either, because they took different days. So it's a very, very complicated picture exactly of what goes on. And our yachas to the Medina within the Torah camp and all the different nuances is a very, very complicated issue, and it just gets more complicated when we deal with issues like the army and how you integrate that and the like. So this is an area of where halacha cannot be separated from ideology and hashkafa and overall philosophy. You know, there are certain areas of halacha that you might call philosophically neutral. If somebody asks me about a Shabbos elevator, you know, we can analyze that without reference to some overarching philosophy of life. But when you ask about the halachot of Yom HaTzmaut and the yachas that one has to Medinat Yisrael, you can't really analyze it in a pure halachic way, because it also depends on some very, very deep hashgafas. So let me just start off with some very basic... Yeah?
In one way, there's a factor, I mean, very simplistic meaning my level.
Right, right. So certainly, I'm going to talk about that. That's a very, very unfortunate thing that people have allowed ideological commitments to overshadow a basic value of Hakarat HaTov. And you're 100% correct. I'll talk about that.
I just wanted to say that Yom HaShoah. I mean, it may not be the right day or whatever, but when they blow the siren, what should be the response? Because I live next door to a little boys' yeshiva, and they were singing at the top of their lungs during the siren.
Yeah. Well, you know, everything in this country is a matter of politics. Everything. It's amazing. Yom HaShoah, you think on some level, should be the least controversial issue in the Jewish calendar to commemorate the Kedoshim who died in the Holocaust. And yet, Yom HaShoah is also a political issue. Now, part of it is this. There's a very interesting history on Yom HaShoah. Yom HaShoah, of course, commemorates the downfall of the Warsaw Ghetto. And why was that event chosen? So the truth of the matter is there is a little bit of a history that involves some pain for Holocaust survivors, and that is some of the early founders of the State of Israel were actually ashamed of the Jews who died so-called passively, like sheep that were led to the slaughter. And there was a belief that Medinat Yisrael represented the ascendancy of a new type of Jew, a Jew that would no longer be a victim, a Jew that would stand up, a Jew that could defend himself. And unlike the passivity that was so characteristic of the Galut mentality. And thus there was almost a certain embarrassment, chas v'shalom, a certain embarrassment, a certain shame about the fact that why didn't more Jews, you know, fight against the Nazis? So as a result, when they were looking for a suitable way to memorialize the Holocaust, they chose the one outstanding instance of Jewish armed resistance against the Nazis, that was the Warsaw Ghetto. Now, although it's 100% the case, obviously, that those who fought in the Warsaw Ghetto were heroes and very, very great people, but at the same time, it's not the only, and that's why it's also called Yom HaShoah V'Hagavurah, V'Hagavurah, the idea of Gavurah. And yet, there were Holocaust survivors who felt that this was an implicit demeaning of those who did not actively fight, but who accepted Hashem's Gezerah because they simply had no other option, and they died al Kiddush Hashem, and their resistance was spiritual resistance rather than physical resistance. So as a result, to this very day, there are those who feel that they don't want to connect to that particular commemoration, besides the fact that it's the month of Nisan as well. You know, you don't have sad events in Nisan. But in terms of Derech Eretz, in terms of not being Porish Minat Tzibor, I think it's very, very unconscionable not to participate in the moment of silence. Now, I would admit that maybe if you're in a Beis Medrash and you're private and you're alone and etc., you know, one could argue that the Talmud Torah that you're doing, at least with conscious intention, might be accomplishing more for the Zecher of the Neshamot. But certainly if you're outside and you're in a public situation where other people are going to see whether you are observing this or not observing this, you cannot be Poresh. You cannot be Poresh Minat Tzibor. And it's an awful thing. It's a callousness. It's stepping on people's feelings. And it's a disrespect to Kedoshim, who died Al-Kiddush Hashem. You know, it's interesting. This issue of spiritual resistance versus physical resistance, you actually see this all the way back in the struggle of the Maccabees against the Yavanim in Hanukkah. You know that the historical source of the Hanukkah story is in what's called Sefer HaMakkabim. Now, this is not part of Tanakh. This is in what we call Svarim Chitzonim, which is the Apocrypha. Actually, it's interesting. It is part of the Catholic Bible. The Catholic Old Testament is larger than our Tanakh. The Catholic Old Testament includes the books of the Apocrypha, the book of the Maccabees and the like. But be it as it may, we do not consider Sefer HaMakkabim to be a holy book, but we do consider it to be a historical book. Now, there's actually four Sefer HaMakkabim. There's Maccabim Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet. Now, Gimel, Dalet are not historical books. They're essentially philosophical books, so they're not part of the Hanukkah story. But Aleph and Beis, a lot of which overlap. There's a lot of repetition. Aleph and Beis are the detailed historical accounts of the 25-year battle that the Chashmonaim, the Maccabim, had against the Syrian Greeks. And as I say, it gives you much more detail than most people are interested in. It's something that is very interesting from a military history standpoint, because the Maccabim were guerrilla warfares, right? The guerrilla fighters, and it discusses all the different strategies that they employed. But what's very fascinating is there's a difference in emphasis between Maccabees 1 and Maccabees 2. And it's two different authors. Maccabees 1 emphasizes military prowess and victory. Maccabees 2 emphasizes martyrdom and willingness to die al Kiddush Hashem. So, for example, the famous story of Chana and her seven sons is in Maccabees 2. Which means, apparently, from the perspective of the authors, we had two different models of Jewish heroism. One model of the... Now again, both of them are religious books, I want to point out. Both of them talk about praying to Hashem, Emunah in Hashem. It's not a question of religious versus secular. Both books have a religious context in which there is tefillah, there is tshuva. Okay, that's not the dichotomy. But what is it that is praiseworthy about the human endeavor? Maccabees 1 represents the gevura of Jewish people fighting and not passively going to their fate. Maccabees 2 highlights the nobility of those who were not able to fight, but they were willing to go to their death before they would violate Hashem's Torah. So it's interesting that that controversy, which exists Lagabe Yom HaShoah, already finds a much earlier precedent in the two different versions of what aspects of heroism do you emphasize. Now the answer is, of course, it's not an either-or choice. One emphasizes both, but that is part of the controversy of Yom HaShoah. Yeah. Say again? Yeah. Yes. In fact, all four books of the Maccabees, I believe, are in the Catholic and the Catholic Bible. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't checked it lately, the Catholic Bible, but so I understand. As opposed, by the way, to the Protestant Bibles that do not have the Apocrypha. The Protestant version of the Old Testament is the same as our Tanakh. But the Catholics, for some reason, have an expanded version of the Old Testament. I call it Old Testament. I mean, a Jew should not refer to Tanakh as the term Old Testament, because Old Testament implies it was superseded. So Old Testament is not a proper term, but I use it because I'm just describing what they call their Bible, or what they call our Bible. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the foundations, though, of Yom HaTzimut. First of all, we have to go back to a fundamental machlokas, the Rambam, Maimonides, the Rambam, and the Ramban, regarding whether or not there is a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. We know that the Rambam wrote a sefer called Sefer HaMitzvot, where he enumerates the 613 mitzvos of the Torah, and then the Ramban wrote commentary and criticism on some of the Rambam's choices, and the Ramban says that the Rambam left out a mitzvah that he should have counted. Now you understand, the Ramban does a few of this. The Ramban has around 10 mitzvos that the Rambam should have counted. But you understand immediately that this creates an arithmetical problem, because we are bound by the concept that there are 613 commandments. And of those 613 commandments, 248 are positives, thou shalt do, and 365 are negatives, thou shalt not do. So every time another commentator is going to add a mitzvah to the list, he has to take something off the list, because otherwise, I mean, the Rambam has 613 commandments. The Ramban claims that the Rambam left some commandments off the list. So you have to add them in. But if you add them in to the Rambam's total, you're going to have more than 613. So as a result, it's kind of like they say, rearranging the chairs on the Titanic, meaning every time you add something, you got to combine things that were separate and put them together. So they figure out how to do it, meaning they go back and forth in doing this. And we're not going to necessarily go over how each thing is addressed. But one of the most important mitzvot that the Ramban claims was omitted from the Rambam's cheshbon is the mitzvah that is called Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And this is based... Now, where is there a mitzvah called Yishuv Eretz Yisrael? What pasuk says you're supposed to live in Eretz Yisrael? The Ramban locates the pasuk in Parshas Masai, at the very end of the book of Bamidbor, V'rishtem osa v'shaftem ba. You shall inherit the land, and you shall dwell in the land. This is not just a commandment for that generation, but the Ramban says this is a commandment for all generations, whether there's a Beis HaMikdash, whether there's not a Beis HaMikdash, that we are supposed to live in the Eretz Yisrael. Now, what's important is that the Ramban then subdivides this into four components. People don't always realize this. Yishuv Eretz Yisrael has four subdivisions. Subdivision one, and this is maybe the most important for Yom HaTzmaut, there is a mitzvah on the Jewish people to establish political sovereignty on all land that is within the biblical boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. Which means, this is the first component. The first component of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is actually Hakamat HaMedina. There needs to be Jewish sovereignty over everything within the Torah's boundaries of the land of Israel. Now, if you go through the Torah's boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, you will see that those boundaries are actually much larger than Medinat Yisrael. Now, although it's true that Medinat Yisrael does include some land that may not be Eretz Yisrael, Eilat, for example, there are different questions about that, but it's also true that there are many, many areas in Assyria, etc., that indeed are technically part of Eretz Yisrael, but we have not yet established it. But nevertheless, the Ramban says, every time we establish Jewish sovereignty on a chelek of a gvul of Eretz Yisrael, we are fulfilling the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Now remember, this is not necessarily a messianic idea, and I'll get to that in a little later. This is a simple mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Now that is component number one. Component number two is that even after Jewish sovereignty has been established, there is a mitzvah to make the land habitable and useful in some way, to either cultivate it by agriculture, by industry, even recreational parkland, by residence, meaning not to leave the land in a state of shemama, desolation. Now, some have said that this aspect of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael you can fulfill even from afar. So if you give money to plant trees, Jewish National Fund, etc., you are making the land more beautiful, more habitable. That is also a vicarious form of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. It is said if you pick up garbage, or maybe even if you don't litter, you're kind of doing a mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael by making the land more beautiful, more miyushevet. Somebody told me a story. Now, the truth of the matter is, one should never litter in a public area, whether it's Eretz Yisrael or Afghanistan. But in Eretz Yisrael, there's a special aveira of disparaging the land, defacing the land. Someone told me a story that somebody had a very religious family, wanted to have a Shabbos meal in a park. So they did a picnic in the park. But then they held that all of their garbage was muktzah. So they said, I'm sorry, they can't take it off the table. So they left everything on the table because they said, what can we do? Once it is garbage, it is muktzah. Well, the answer to that is very simple. First of all, the garbage is not muktzah. But putting it aside, if they want to be machmir on Hilchos Muktzah, then you don't have a picnic in a park on Shabbos. That's the only solution. You could be as machmir as you want, but as Rabbi Saul Salanter said, you cannot be a tzaddik on somebody else's cheshbon, right? So it's absolutely crazy to make a picnic with the intention that you're not going to remove your garbage because of the laws of muktzah. Okay, but be it as it may, unfortunately, as the environmental consciousness of not littering has not pervaded Israeli consciousness to a great extent. And the truth of the matter is, it's a violation of this second aspect of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Aspect number three, third component. This is all Ramban. Third component of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And this is mamish prophetic, because it would almost make no sense except in light of what happened later. It is forbidden psychologically for a Jew to consider any other country in the world as a Jewish homeland other than Eretz Yisrael. Even if you happen to live somewhere else. But you have to regard Eretz Yisrael as the homeland of the Jewish people. Now again, what is the Ramban referring to? It's absolutely prophetic words. You remember, and again, Theodor Herzl's intentions were absolutely good. I mean, I'm not maligning his intentions. But at various points, you know, Herzl perceived the need for a Jewish state as essentially an antidote to the scourge of European anti-Semitism. Right, Herzl experienced the Dreyfus trial, all sorts of experiences like that. He saw the resurgence of anti-Semitism in spite of liberation and the ghetto walls falling. And Herzl thought the Jews would have their own state, their own army, their own pickpockets, their own normalization, so to speak. Then the world would respect us. Then we would no longer be outliers. We would no longer be outcasts. And he saw a Jewish state, normalization, as a solution to anti-Semitism. Now, as a result, although he did prefer the land of Israel, or Palestine as it was called, because we had historical ties, but if that became difficult, he was willing to negotiate for Uganda, other places. And yet the Ramban is saying we're not allowed to identify Borough Park or Muncie or Lakewood as the Jewish, right? People like to say, they used to say Baltimore or Toronto was the Yerushalayim of America. Now they say Yerushalayim is the Baltimore of Israel. You know, they say. No, the real Makom Kadosh is there. Baruch Hashem, Yerushalayim is almost like Baltimore. That's what people say. Yeah, people say today. So the Ramban says, no. Maybe circumstances require that I live here and there. Sometimes life puts me in that position. But the homeland has to be Eretz Yisrael. That's the third component. The fourth component is the one that everybody normally identifies. That's the individual chiyuv on you to actually live here. You see, so it's interesting that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, which everybody thinks just means a mitzvah to live here, that's only one of four components. There's a mitzvah of political sovereignty. There's a mitzvah, shalom, that it should not be shemama. There's a psychological idea that this is our home. And then there's the actual situation of living here, unless there's a heter. Now, I want to point out that obviously Chazal recognized that this mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael, even like Ramban, is not an absolute mitzvah. There are heterim not to live here. For example, to find a wife, to learn Torah, although that's difficult to apply that today. There's so much Torah here. Parnasa, if you have adolescent children, anyone that's making our aliyah needs to certainly talk to a spiritual advisor about those issues. So when I say it's a chiyuv like the Ramban, I don't mean it is a chiyuv unconditionally, no matter what. But the mindset of a person has to be. I am supposed to live here unless I have a real good reason not to. Now again, there can be good reasons. You know, we have to be realistic. Halacha recognizes good reasons, but you can't just ignore it. I mean, part of our problem in the Western world in particular is that living in Eretz Yisrael is simply not on... I mean, obviously I'm speaking to the converted, so I don't need to make the point. But it's not even on the radar. And what the Ramban is teaching is you have to have a different orientation. You have to start off with the premise, I am obligated to live here unless there are deep and significant reasons why I shouldn't. And again, halacha will recognize a lot of those reasons. But you have to have that mindset. You can't just ignore it, as it were. Now, this is so these four components collectively are called the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Now, one of the big mysteries that people might ask is, so how come the Ramban himself didn't live here until the very end of his life. Ramban, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, lived in Spain, Catholic Spain, and he was considered to be one of the Gedolei Hador, maybe the Gadol Hador in the generation after the Rambam. The Rambam was already not alive. And if you know the story, towards the end of his life, he was invited, quotation marks, he was compelled to participate in a public debate against an apostate Jew who became a Dominican friar, in which they had to defend Judaism against various attacks, etc. And this was the famous Vikuach HaRamban, called the Disputation at Barcelona. I think they made a play out of it, and a show out of it, all sorts of things. But the Ramban himself gave us a write-up of the Vikuach. And at the end of the Vikuach, this was a popular entertainment of the time, the audience voted who was the winner. And the Ramban was adjudicated to be the winner of the debate, Kiddush Hashem. He really didn't want to participate in this because he saw this as a no-win game. Because if, God forbid, Judaism is discredited, that is a Chilul Hashem. And if Judaism emerges triumphant, that's a defamation of the church. Who knows how the church is going to respond? And it's so interesting, it was very recorded, that the debate went on for several days. And at some point, the priests wanted to discontinue it. They wanted to cut off the microphone. They said, this is not going our way. And they actually wanted the debate to be prematurely terminated and the like. And they actually wanted the Ramban to be executed. Executed. Because in the course of the debate, he said negative things about the Catholic Church. The king of Aragon, King James, actually liked the Ramban. In fact, he gave the Ramban a gift and he told the Ramban, I've never seen such an eloquent defense of a false position. He says, all of your teachings are wrong, he said. No, that's what the king said, but you defended them so nicely. And anyway, only because of the king. The king managed to the king had to negotiate with the clergy that instead of the Ramban being executed, he will be exiled from Spain. So the Ramban was kicked out of Spain. That's the bad news. The good news is, he then came to Eretz Yisrael, and he lived in Eretz Yisrael around 10 years. He wrote his commentary on the Chumash in Eretz Yisrael. He established a Beit Knesset that is still functioning. It's not the same building, but the same site. The Beit Knesset HaRamban in the Old City is, I think, the oldest continuous, except for 1948 to 67. It has been in continuous operation as a Beit Knesset since the 1200s. This is the Ramban's Beit Knesset. And we even have letters that he wrote in which he describes the unbelievable desolation and emptiness of the land. There was not even a minyan of Jews in Yerushalayim. And they had to get a Sefer Torah from Hebron to have services. For a while, the Ramban went to Akko. Akko had around 500 Jews. There were Balei Atosvos from France. And the Ramban gave his famous Drasha of Rosh Hashanah in Akko. But then he migrated back to Yerushalayim because even though there were no Jews there. Again, the reason why Yerushalayim was so desolate and Akko had a relatively large Jewish community is at the time Akko was under the Christians. Again, every year changed, but the Christians at that time were more tolerant of Jews than were the Muslims. Jerusalem was under Islamic control, so you had to kind of move around from this place to that place to that place depending on who was control of the land. So, and the Ramban, now the truth is we don't even know where the Ramban is buried, that's which is kind of very strange. The Ramban spent the last decade of his life here. He died here. Unlike the Rambam, who died in Egypt and is buried in Tveria, we know where the Rambam's grave is. Strangely enough, we're not entirely clear where the Ramban is buried. That's very, very peculiar. Why would we not be aware of it? Different people will point out different possibilities, but we don't have a definitive location of the kever of the Ramban. But be it as it may, the question still becomes, if the Ramban takes the position, there's a mitzvah d'oraisa of living in Eretz Yisrael, why did he not go until he was forced to do so? He was in his 70s. So the truth is, we don't really have a definitive answer, but there are two answers that are commonly given. Answer number one was that in those days, the trip itself was a matter of pikuach nefesh. It was a matter of true danger to life. There were pirates and marauders and wild animals, and the sea voyages were very, very hazardous. And as a result, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael does not require you to put your life in danger. It's not one of the three mitzvot for which you have to give your life. Now, people today sometimes still use that argument. But today it's not a valid argument. They say, I can't live in Israel. Israel is so dangerous. Pikuach nefesh. Yeah, right. Israel is a lot more dangerous than Paris, let's say, and
San Diego.
That's right, San Diego, Pittsburgh, and the like. The truth of the matter is, in terms of walking around at night, you know, what American city can people walk around? You know, women even walk around, you know, at night, 10 o'clock at night, relatively okay. No American city is that safe. So the truth of the matter is, for people to use pikuach nefesh as a heter, not to make aliyah, is absolutely invalid. I mean, no one's telling you to live in Hebron or the like. That's a separate issue. But nevertheless, in the Ramban's time, pikuach nefesh was a real concern. The second possibility was that the Ramban was the Gadol Hador, and the Ramban was needed by many, many Jews. There were very few Jews in Eretz Israel. And if that's the case, a Gadol needs to be accessible to where people can reach him. In those days, they didn't have telephone, they didn't have email. The Ramban needed to be where Yidden were. Now today, of course, that argument has less of a resonance because of communication. Okay, but still, it's sometimes said that there are Rabbanim, or spiritual leaders, who do not make Aliyah because it is said that they are so needed by their communities that their achrayut to their community overrides the individualistic mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael. It is said that the Chafetz Chaim wanted to make Aliyah, and the Gedolei HaDor said, you're not allowed to leave, you have to stay with us because we need you. Now, my answer to that is, my response to that is that a person has to be realistic, meaning to say, every rabbi likes to think that my community will absolutely disintegrate. What do they say? They say when a rabbi goes on vacation, there are two things that they are afraid of. One is the community will fall apart without them. And the other is the community will do great. He says, you know, you're afraid of either possibility, in a way. And there are people, there are Rabbanim, and there are people that I could identify who quite literally, you know, without them, everything would fall apart. And it may very well be that they have an achrayat not to go. Most of the time, communities, you know, do recover, do survive, do flourish even in one way or the other. Okay, but be it as it may, in the case of the Ramban, the two classical heterim that were understood was pikuach nefesh and the fact that he was needed by Klal Yisrael and could not necessarily take that luxury. So this is the Shitas HaRamban on Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Now in terms of Yom HaAtzma'ut, what is most important here is to keep in mind that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael does not only include the mitzvah to live in the land of Israel, but as the first component indicated, there is actually a mitzvah in the establishment of Jewish sovereignty. That is part of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. A Jewish state is the fulfillment of that mitzvah. Living here under Arab rule or British rule or Ottoman rule would be part of the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael. I'm living in Eretz Yisrael, but it would not be the completion of the fulfillment until there's Jewish sovereignty. Now, keep in mind that all of this is Ramban's Shita. Rambam does not count it as a mitzvah. Now, what are the implications of that? Now, it's always hard to know what the implications of a negative are. The Rambam doesn't say it's not a mitzvah. He just doesn't count it as a mitzvah. What are the implications? So there are two approaches in the commentaries as to what is the Rambam's opinion. One opinion is, indeed, the Rambam says there is no mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. Now, obviously, it's a good thing, it's a holy thing, it's a noble thing. The Rambam talks about the holiness of the land, but it's not a mitzvah. If I want to live in the Gola, according to this approach, the Rambam would say, I can live in the Gola. That's approach number one in the Rambam. Approach number two in the Rambam is mikatze elakatze. And that is, the reason the Rambam doesn't count it as a mitzvah is not because it's not a mitzvah, but it's because it's what we might call a super mitzvah. Meaning, the Rambam lays down a rule that we never count as a mitzvah to keep the Torah. Like, you know, Hashem says in the Torah many times, you shall keep my mitzvahs. Well, do we have a mitzvah called keep my mitzvahs? No, we don't. Because that's not adding anything. That's just 613 individual mitzvahs with a general statement. Well, some mefarshim learn, since every mitzvah accomplishes its ultimate goal only in Eretz Yisrael, a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael is nothing more than a mitzvah to keep the whole Torah. So it's not counted, not because it's not a mitzvah, but because it's a mitzvah that makes every other thing you do a mitzvah. And therefore, the Rambam would be moda to the Ramban that you should live here, right? In other words, so there's a machlokas how to learn the Rambam. So you really have two questions from a strict halachic point. Number one, we have a machlokas, Rambam and Ramban, right? Who do we paskin like? And number two, if we paskin like Rambam, what is Rambam's view? Nevertheless, the Vilna Gaon and many other authorities do say that we paskin like Ramban, that there is a mitzvah of Yish of Eretz Yisrael. Now, let me give you a countertext. And this countertext is a Gemara in Maseches Ksuvas. And this is a very, very famous Gemara. This Gemara is the basis of the ideology of the Satmar Rebbe, of Neturei Karta, of really all of the groups that do not recognize the state of Israel, and God forbid, even call on some level for its dismantlement. And that is the Gemara in Kesuvos on the Pasuk in Shir HaShirim. There's a verse in Shir HaShirim that says, Hishbati etchem benos Yerushalayim, right? The Jewish people turn to the daughters of Jerusalem, not identified, and say, I make you swear, im ta'oru, im ta'iru, v'im ta'iru esa'ava, you shall not awaken, you shall not stir up God's love, ad shetechpatz, until God's love comes of its own accord. Don't stir up the kettle or the pot. What does that mean? That appears three times in Shir HaShirim. So the Gemara said, at the time of the Chorban of the Beis HaMikdash, God imposed three oaths, three Shavuos, on the Jewish people. Three oaths. Oath number one, Lo Yalu Bachoma. Do not climb the wall, which means do not try to conquer the land of Israel by military force. Lo Yalu Bachoma. Shavua number two, Lo Yimredu Biumot. Do not rebel against your host nation. Be a faithful citizen of whatever country you're living in. Do not be a revolutionary. Number three, lo yidchaku es haketz. Do not try to bring the Mashiach before his time. Again, you can raise questions with various messianic activists. Now, the Turikarta Satmir say, lo yalu b'choma is a divine oath that we are not supposed to establish a state until the Mashiach comes. And in point of fact, therefore, one has to understand that Neturei Karta's ideology... Now, by the way, today we look at Neturei Karta as kind of a lunatic fringe. They meet with Ahmadinejad, and etc. You kind of have to ignore the crazy element there. Because the truth of the matter is, the Neturei Karta philosophy that their Jewish statehood is hashkafically and halachically problematic was not a lunatic position. In fact, before 1948... it was the position of many, including Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch and the like. It was kind of almost a mainstream in many, many circles. Today it's not. But they argue that it is wrong to have a state, not because the state is not religious and not because the state does things, you know, against people who learn Torah. Nothing to do with that. Their position is, even if the prime minister would be the Gadol Hador, and the cabinet would be Rosh Yeshiva, and everybody is the Tzadikim Gemurim Mamash, we are not allowed to have a state. Because Galus is seen as God's decree, and only God can take us out of the exile. And it is a rebellion, it's called Merida B'Malchut Shemayim, to try to end the Galus prematurely. Now that is the Neturei Karta Shita, and that is based on the Gemara and Kesuvos, Gimel Shavuos. Now we know that most of the Torah world does not accept that, and let me explain why. There is a Gemara. Well, number one, it's an isolated Gemara. Who says it's halacha? It's not brought in the Rambam or the Shulchan Aruch. It's an agadic statement, and there's always a question of how binding those individual statements are. But number two, it's been pointed out that the state of Israel was not established by a war of aggression. Remember, the first Shvuah does not prohibit statehood. It prohibits establishing a state by military conquest. Well, the War of Independence in 1948 was not an aggressive war. What happened basically was the United Nations approved the partition of Palestine into the different components. The Jewish state was declared, Hei Iyar, 1948. And immediately after the Jewish state was declared and the British took away their flag, we get attacked by all of these countries. The Milchamet HaShichrur was a defensive war. And in fact, every war the State of Israel has ever fought, even if it takes the form of a preemptive strike, but essentially, it is a defensive war. There are no wars of aggression. So one argument has been that whatever the Gemara in Kesuvos means, it does not apply to the State of Israel at all, because the State of Israel does not fight, no matter what people on the left may say. We do not fight wars of aggression. We fight wars of defense, because people try to destroy us in various ways, and therefore a war of defense is not nichlal in the prohibition of lo yalu b'choma. That is one answer. A second response is, if you look at the rest of the Gemara, you will see that just as God imposed three oaths on the Jewish people, God imposed an oath on the Umot HaOlam. And the oath on the Umot HaOlam was, Lo Yishabdu Yisrael Yoser Midai. You will not oppress the Jewish people excessively. So this was a package deal. Hashem basically tells us, be passive, be quiescent, don't rebel, be loyal. And the Umot HaOlam were told, treat them decently. Well, we know if you have a lease, right? The lease has promises of the landlord, promises of the tenant. Well, if one side does not live up to their commitments, that releases the other side. That releases the other side. And if that's the case, the history of the persecution of the Jews, whether it's the Crusades, whether it's the pogroms, whether it's the Holocaust, essentially releases us of any restriction that we had. Right? In fact, by the way, if you go back to the first point, that the State of Israel was not established by military conquest. It was established by international consent. It is said that in 1918 or 17? The Balfour Declaration is 1918, right? 17, okay. Yeah, that when the Balfour Declaration was issued in 1917, the Chafetz Chaim, who was still alive, was very happy. He said, the oath has now been annulled because we are not establishing Eretz Medinat Yisrael by rebellion. We are establishing it by international consensus. Now, on one level, that could be painful to the Jewish ego. Why do we need the Goyim to tell us? On the other hand, halachically, it's actually a very useful thing, because that is how we avoided violating the Shvuah of Lo Yalu Bachom. So, the bottom line, therefore, would be, unless you accept Nitzurei Karta and the Satmar position, the establishment of a Medina is not only permitted, but according to Ramban, would be the fulfillment of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Now, we can go further. We don't have time, unfortunately, to talk about the messianic implications of Reishit Smichat Gulotenu. Rav Kook took the position, although Rav Kook died, of course, before there was a state, but he took the position that both the return of the Jews to Eretz Yisrael, the fertility of the land, and the eventual establishment of a Jewish state, which he saw was coming, is a sign of Mashiach coming, a sign of redemption. That is the controversial words in the Tefillah, Lishlom HaMedina, Reishit Tzmichat Gulatenu. So there are those that do see this as part of the redemption process. And people then say, but how can this be part of the redemption process? Number one, we're facing so many wars. If it's part of redemption, it should bring peace. And number two, so many people who were involved in the founding of the state and even in the present government don't accept the Torah and they rebel against the Torah. Can this be God's way of bringing redemption? But Rav Kook's response to that was that this is the deep secret of Geula. The deep secret of Geula is that God will find ways to bring every Jew back to him. Some people come to Eretz Yisrael because of their connection to God, and some will come to God because of their connection to Eretz Yisrael. So Hashem uses all the tools at his disposal. You could be a communist, you could be a socialist, you could be whatever it is that gets you here. And you think you're coming here because of some political philosophy. But really, what brought you here was the stirrings of your neshama to be close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whether you know that or not. Now, people say Rav Kook was an optimist. He was naive, okay, you know, so to speak. He went through life always seeing the good in people. And, well, whatever it is, we certainly have seen many cases, not all cases, where people have come back to Hashem, if not themselves, their children, their grandchildren. Eventually it happens. And nevertheless, Rav Kook also made the point that even if a person is secular, even if a person is a non-believer, if they are building up the land, they are deserving of gratitude and admiration and appreciation, because they are doing holy work, whether we know it or not, whether they know it or not. So, what I would say overall, this really just goes back to your point at the very beginning, whether this is the beginning of a messianic process or not, and we don't really know, certainly a day like Yom HaTzmaut should engender within every Jew a sense of appreciation appreciation to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that in the awful aftermath of the unspeakable tragedies of the Holocaust, he gave us a hug and a smile and a kiss. Again, this is not explaining the Holocaust, but it's basically saying, know that I love you, know that I care about you, know that I'll give you a place where you can come and be near to me. Appreciation to Hashem. Even the Brisker Rav, who was an anti-Zionist, and I can't reconcile all the statements, said that Hakamat HaMedina after the Holocaust was a smile from heaven. I don't know how to reconcile that with 10 other statements the Brisker Rav said against the state, but it is recorded that he said this was a chiyuch min hashamayim, to show that he loves us. Again, it's not explaining everything that came before, but it is a reassurance of divine love. So it's Hakaras HaTov to Hashem, and Hakaras HaTov to a state, to a structure, with which we have the right to disagree and should disagree, as all citizens of a democratic country can disagree. But we cannot deny that a structure and an infrastructure was created that enables Jews to come from everywhere in the world. The very first law of the land of Israel, first secular law, was the law of return. You know, Robert Frost said, a home is where they can't kick you out. Well, we have a few exceptions, you know, the various extradition issues, Mayor Lansky, whatever it would be. Once in a while, there's a problem. But by and large, you know, they can't kick you out. You come here. In fact, we take in people that, you know, logically maybe we shouldn't always take in. But we take it in. You know, this is your home. So, the army, the police, you know, I've mentioned this before, so forgive me for repeating it, but to me, and you may remember when the issue about the draft of yeshiva boys, etc., first became a major, I mean, it's been an issue since 1948, but when it resurfaced in earnest around 2 or 3 years ago, so there was a massive demonstration near the central bus station, maybe 800,000 people, and that's what they said. And it was not violent, it was tefillah, as demonstrations go, it was a good one, so to speak. And they argued about the primacy of Torah. And people said, oh, it's a Kiddush Hashem, it was wonderful, they made the case. But I thought to myself, maybe I'm too sarcastic, but I thought to myself, you know, Baruch Hashem, it was good, no violence, no insulting, nobody was called Amalek. You know, that's major progress in how we conduct demonstrations. Nobody knocked over any dumpsters. But what would have been if at the end of this demonstration they would have said a tefillah for the chayolim? I don't know what would have been, but I think Mashiach might have come. And I'm not that person who just throws these things out. Because here is the thing. A person can have a shita. In fact, some I share that shita that Torah learning is absolutely so important that, you know, we have to have people who are learning Torah, because without that there is no siyata dishmaya. But at the same time, you have to have gratitude for people who are risking their lives. And we're all on the same team. It's not an I versus them. It's just as in the army itself. Not everybody is in a combat unit. There are people who are in computers and there are people who are cooks. Because we recognize everybody is needed. Torah people, Torah learners are needed, of course. Chayalim are needed, paratroopers are needed, computer people are needed, intelligence officers are needed. We're on the same team. We appreciate what everyone is doing. We recognize their sacrifices. We acknowledge those sacrifices. So even if you're in a demonstration which is taking a position that certain people ought to be exempt from a draft, if you're taking that position, I know we can argue about that, that doesn't mean you don't appreciate the people that are serving. And if there would have been that recognition, that in spite of our shita, which is different, we acknowledge, we validate, we appreciate, we're grateful, I think that would have changed things enormously for the good. And this is Shlomo HaMelech's pasuk in Mishlei, really a motto that we should put on our refrigerators. Kemayim apanim alpanim kem leif adam liadam. Water reflects the face that you show it, so too the heart of one person reflects that which you show it. The Vilna Gaon explains, when I look into water, the face that I show the water is the face I get back from the water. I smile at the water, I see a smiling face. I frown at the water, I see a frowning face. The heart of a human being reflects back that which you show it. I show respect, admiration, kavod. They will feel that way for me. I show denigration, disrespect, demonization. They will feel that way about me. So, if you want to know why religious secular tensions never get resolved in Israel, it's precisely because they don't learn Tanakh in yeshivas, and they don't learn the pasuk Kamayim Apanim Opanim. If I spend my time yelling and shouting about how treif you are, you will look at me as someone destructive and evil and no good. If, however, we could create an ethic of gratitude and appreciation, then I think those of a different orientation would feel a gratitude and appreciation for what religion and Torah contributes to the life of Eretz Yisrael. So, as I say, whether you say Hallel, don't say Hallel, these are frankly technicalities, and one should follow whatever Psak Halacha they follow. It's not a major issue. But not to have gratitude, not to have Hakara Satov, is really a crime. The very definition of a Jew, Yehudi, quite literally, means a grateful person. Leah called her fourth son Yehuda. That's where Yehudim come from. Because she said, Hapam Odeh Hashem. Now, I am grateful to God. So, you know, in some of the dictionaries, the American Heritage Dictionary, I think this was taken out a few years ago, they have a dictionary of slang. So they put Jew, in some parts of the South, is a verb that means to cheat somebody in business. So somebody in Mississippi might say, don't Jew around with me. Well, I think that was taken out, anti-Semitic, but you know, the truth of the matter is, it's that's the usage, that is a usage. A slang dictionary is supposed to tell you what those words mean. But we would say, to Jew means to appreciate, to be grateful. Jew is also a verb, but it's a verb of appreciation and gratitude. So this is, I think, what we need to think about, that, you know, people ask all sorts of questions on God. How could God allow a Holocaust? You know, and I'm not going to answer these questions. Eov wanted an answer. He didn't get an answer. Moshe Rabbeinu wanted an answer. He didn't get an answer. But we have to know that as devastating as the Holocaust was, for there to be a Medina, and for there to be a Jewish people, and for there to be all of the Torah learning and all of the economic development and all of the scientific development and all of the agricultural development, that too is an absolute miracle. And it's something we have to be grateful for. Grateful to people, grateful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that's, I think, what we should think about on Yom HaTzmut, whether you say Hallel, whether you have a barbecue, or however you commemorate it. So all be well. So we will see you next month.
Fourth week.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Okay.
That's when you're going to start. When you come back.
Yes. The day after I come back, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
What are the sources for the subtypes of the...